Welcome to session 351, Mobilizing the Saints, Behind-the-Scenes Strategies on Same-Sex Marriage. And this is a dual paper presentation. So it's a little different than the paper respondent or the panel type ones. But there are just a couple of reminders before I introduce the speakers. As always, you know, turn off or silence your cell phones and stuff. I've been hearing a lot of ringers this week, so just if you could just think about doing that real quick right now, if you haven't already. And neither of you have books. It's all right. Okay, all right. Then we're covered there. Okay, our first paper is going to be presented by Laura Compton, and Laura has a degree in journalism from Humboldt State University and is on the board of directors of Sunstone. She lives in the Bay Area, Cupertino, California. Laura is also, just to say, go forward personally, Laura is sort of the curator of and moderator of the Mormons for Marriage organization. It's a website, discussion list, sort of activist force. And I've really admired her from my sort of passive involvement in that, because she has done a really fantastic job of balancing active, full-fledged membership in the church, faithful, coming from a very positive, church-positive perspective, and yet has been interviewed in the national press several times as a representative for Mormons who are in favor of same-sex marriage. And as far as I know, you still have a good relationship with your local leaders just as a model that these things can be done, that we actually can do these things. I think Laura's great at that. Following Laura, we're going to have a presentation from Joseph West, who has a master's of sociology at the University of Arizona, a PhD candidate currently in sociology from the University of Arizona. And it didn't get as much press, but in addition to Prop 8, there were similar constitutional amendments that were voted on at the same time in Florida and in Arizona, and I lived in Arizona during that period. And I don't know what happened in Florida, but I know in Arizona that there were sort of similar things that happened to the members in California in Arizona, but it was just a little more low-key, kind of kept off the radar for some reason. But it'll be interesting to hear Joseph kind of give us a perspective on how that went in Arizona. Laura.
We're going to do the sitting down so that we can rest from our labors. And if you can't see the slide screen, I would encourage you to move to where you can see it. It's not as critical for mine, but it is more critical for Joseph. So feel free to get up in the middle of the talking. I don't care. I know that when you toe the line, you're generally considered to be conforming to rules and regulations. And yet it also puts me in mind of the old LDS gent's favorite story, the stagecoach. You know, the one about the stagecoach drivers who's looking for a job, and the interviewer says, "How close to the edge of the cliff are you going to go?" And all the bravado, machismo guys say, "Oh, I can get, you know, within an inch of the line, and I can get within a hairbreadth of the line, and I can ride mine right on the edge." And the guy who gets the job is the one who's way over the cliff, far away from the line. So who hasn't been tempted to reach out and see just how close they can get to the imaginary cliff? And here we are today, searching for yet another demarcation line, this time the hard-to-find one between moral issues on one hand and political issues on the other. And maybe we'll find out whether it's even necessary to make a distinction between the two when we're talking about marriage. Time and again, as the LDS Church has stepped into the political arena, it insists that it does so on moral grounds, that the issues it involves itself with are not political but moral. How does the church define moral, and why does it insist on couching its political involvement in those terms? Morals have to do with standards of right or wrong. We believe that for many issues, social issues in contemporary society, God has given applicable moral standards of right and wrong. These time-proven principles are important to us as religious people. Previous First Presidency statements have identified some of the areas where issues of morality are involved, such as failure of fathers to care for families, elimination of statutory homosexual and lesbian activities, abortion, and similar concerns. This is from the March 1980 insert to the inside that had to do with why the church was involved with the ERA. Moral, again, from that same insert, moral issues arise when basic freedoms pertaining to the family and society's moral climate are threatened. In addition to these, the First Presidency has identified several moral issues throughout the years, including the ones on this next slide, which are the Equal Rights Amendment, same-sex marriage, gambling, drinking regulation, at least here in Utah, smoking, and pornography. On places within LDS materials, we have suicide and reporting confessed child abuse as notated as being moral issues. However, there haven't been First Presidency statements demarcating them as moral issues. So it's possible that those are just an editor's choice of words to define them as moral. Finally, and on the next slide, Elder Oaks discussed moral issues with some college students a few years back, and this is what he said. In the United States, the moral absolutes are the ones derived from what we refer to as the Judeo-Christian tradition as set forth in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. Fundamental to the role of religion in public policy is this most important question: are there moral absolutes? Speaking to our BYU students earlier in 1992, President Rex E. Lee said, quote, "I cannot think of anything more important than for each of you to build a firm personal testimony that there are in this life some absolutes, things that never change, regardless of time, place, or circumstances. They are eternal truths, eternal principles, and as Paul tells us, they are and will be the same yesterday, today, and forever." So that's what the church thinks about moral issues. So what does it do when it takes action? 13 years ago, after summarizing the political efforts made by LDS church leaders in battles against equal rights and same-sex marriage in Hawaii, Mike Quinn wrote, "Can a church provide improved public morality if its leaders and members engage in ethical compromise during their involvement in the political arena? Can a church suffer internal spiritual decline by engaging in such normative activities in the secular world? And perhaps most significant for non-U.S. Mormons, can a minority church suffer a popular backlash by taking actions which affect the political lives of millions of non-members?" 2 years ago, in writing about the political efforts made by LDS church leaders in the battle against Prop 8 in California, an LDS attorney wrote, "Relying on deceptive arguments is not only contrary to gospel principles, but ultimately works against the very mission of the church." This year, we've seen some backlash against the LDS church because of the way it involved itself in political campaigns as reporters, bloggers, courts, lawyers, and movie producers have begun documenting the way the public ways the church has involved itself in California's elections. That the LDS church was intimately involved in these campaigns, same-sex marriage issues in Hawaii and California, and the ERA nationally, is no secret. Despite the fact that church leaders tried very hard to distance themselves from the political machinations at the time they were happening. Here, we'll examine whether political actions taken by the church as it defended its moral stances were ethically compromising. In order to do that, I would have a little definition. To be ethical is to be honest, honorable, respectful, truthful, scrupulous, to act with integrity, and to comply with the law. Now, there's not really a whole lot of difference between the game plans for the ERA for Hawaii or for California. We'll take a look at that, and it's quite clear that the action on moral issues will follow the pattern that was set forth in those early campaigns. But has that pattern of action on moral issues been the highest ethical caliber, or does it matter that the church leaders open the doors to the political mud pit and encourage members to follow full force? When anyone enters the political arena, is there really a distinction between moral speech or action and political speech or action? Perhaps once you enter the political square, your actions automatically become political, so morality is set aside as the debate rages on. It's not uncommon to hear traditional marriage supporters argue that the actions of the Mormon church hierarchy should not have been surprising. They were doing exactly what any political campaign organizers would do. But should we expect more from the morality gatekeepers, religions in general, when it comes to public actions? Certainly much of what the Mormon leaders did and encouraged during the ERA in Hawaii's future and 8, and Propositions 22 and Propositions 8 were well within the realm of moral, ethical behavior. But somewhere along the way, perhaps due to the heat of the battle, or the advice of political pundits, or the desires to outquote the Pope, at some point during each of these campaigns, lines were approached and sometimes crossed. And as the line crossing continues to occur, it cannot be written off as a fluke because it seems to be a pattern. So what can we or should we do as non-general authorities about it? Let's take a look at what was done. We'll look at our first chart here. Now, these are kind of arranged in order of seriousness from my brain. So first, the thing that the church did, the questions are, the ERA, HFT is Hawaii's future today. That was about 1996 to 1999. Prop 8 was just 2 years ago, and the ERA was the late 70s. First, the church deemed political events moral issues, thereby justifying their own involvement. The first presidency sent letters to members concerning the topic at hand. Members were asked to donate to political actions in other states. Specific advice was given about what could and could not be done in church buildings. Priesthood leadership chains of command were used to send messages from Salt Lake City to members across the country or in the respective voting areas. Church buildings were used for voter education. Chapels were used as venues for political firesides. There was instruction that people should be asked to help but not necessarily set apart to do the political work, but bishops did issue requests for volunteers and informal callings. Instructions were given to members that included getting involved but not stating their own religious affiliation. They were to appear as just regular standard citizens of the country. And leaflets and political materials were handed out and available at church meetings. So these were kind of, you know, on the borderline of the actors. And certainly the things at the beginning of the list are things that are very reasonable for any church to do in speaking out of moral issues. Let me go to our next slide. The church worked in combination with other religious groups. People who'd never been previously politically involved were motivated to join. Church attorneys and BYU professors gave input both on trial briefs and on legislation. They both offered their advice, and their advice was solicited. State presidencies spoke about the issues in local wards. Local coalition leaders had ties to an easy access and direction from general authorities in Salt Lake City. There were calls for letters, postcards, emails, telephone calls to politicians or other legislative types. And those because of the response from Mormons, it was a disproportionately successful because they appeared to be grassroots messaging coming out of nowhere, but really they had been directed. Spokespeople outside of Salt Lake City continued to represent their actions as were local and self-driven until outside non-members, usually the press, connected the dots between the actions and the church. Efforts were made to keep connections between LDS members' individual political donations quiet. So as an individual, you know, there wasn't a lot of trumpeting saying that the stakes have quotas to fill. Instead, it was more all this money is coming from these interested individuals. The political action committees formed by LDS church members failed to complete all campaign filing requirements in a timely manner. This happened in every single election that the church was ever involved in. They need better lawyers. References to LDS church should not be included in political action committee names. That was a direct request when they were providing, creating campaigns for ERA and for Hawaii's Future Today. The coalitions were already named when the church became involved with the Prop 8 and Prop 22 things. The Special Affairs Committee of the Church, the Public Affairs Committee, which is made up of three or four, depending on the time period, there are three or four members of the Quorum of the 12 and often a person from the PR department. They were involved but were behind the scenes and did not publicly acknowledge their involvement at all. And in fact, to the media and to the general public, they said that they were not involved. Potential donors to political campaigns were identified by church leaders, sometimes including those with ties directly to the Public Affairs Committee. So the Public Affairs Committee was aware of foundations that were created to support Mormon interests, and they encourage local bishops to say, why don't you contact these guys and see, you know, we know they have money, why don't you see if they've got some money they'd like to donate to this political event for us. And then finally, some of the more egregious descriptions were given to the public about the LDS leadership involvement in the campaign and legislative process, but those descriptions were not completely accurate and were not provided on a voluntary basis. The church did not step up to the plate and say, we're involved, we're asking our members to do this, this is all the work that we're doing. The church was kicking and screaming to the confessional. The evidence we have for these church actions are firsthand accounts of members, publicly available documents which, like required political reporting, trial evidence, exhibits, testimony, letters, blogs, and emails of volunteers both within the church and with outside of the church. Church training materials specifically created for the campaigns, which included pamphlets, handouts, fireside transcripts, and web content from official sources, and correspondence between general authorities. The correspondence between general authorities has generally been leaked correspondence, but it is out here and available. We're going to talk about the correspondence next. The correspondence that has been leaked delineates exactly what was done. It confirms the extent to which the church wanted to remain anonymous in order so that it could make a difference and protect its own image as being politically neutral at the same time. It identifies a chain of command and how financial volunteer leadership support was committed, and it provides color and background as to the feelings of some church leaders toward political involvement. In some cases, they're quite damning as far as the duplicity that has been involved. Finally, in the case of the most recent FPPC is the Fair Political Practices Commission of California. It was involved investigating the church over donations that were not timely reported in the Proposition 8 campaign in 2008. Since most of the publicly available documents have already been discussed at Sunstone presentations, and since we've got some limited time here, we're going to focus on some of the more recent stuff, which is the FPPC letters. Each of the things that we're going to talk about is kind of a tip of an iceberg kind of thing. There's lots of other documentation out there. We just don't have time to look at it here today. But there are places on the internet where you can find some other stuff. So let's go to the first, and we're going to talk about, there's two letters that we're going to discuss. First is a letter from the church's Associate General Counsel, Boy G. Black. He works down here over off of Temple Square. His letter was dated January 15th, 2009, and it is a response to the complaint filed against the church because of the letter. The second letter is a letter from James R. Sutton of the Sutton Law Firm, and that was the California legal entity that was retained to represent the church in the matter. It was just kind of a follow-up, providing some more information that the church didn't have previously. So we'll take a look at the first slide, and it talks about why the church was involved, and it calls the issue of marriage a core doctrinal principle of the church, saying that marriage is a divine and sacred institution ordained from God from the foundation of the world. And the fact that it's a core principle doctrine of the church is important in the legal political realm, because the church needs to be able to say that it's speaking on something that's doctrinal in order to say what it's saying in the political arena. This confirms that the church was invited to join the Protect Marriage campaign, and it also confirms that it did appropriate due diligence. That's a term of art in the legal world. It means that they did a lot of research before stepping in. They talked to people, they reviewed documents, they knew exactly what they were getting into, and considering the people who were involved in Hawaii, and the people who were involved in Prop 22, and the people who were involved in Prop 8, they've known each other for a couple decades. It also says that, so that's talking about joining the coalition. We'll go to the next one. Recognizing the need for compliance, the church knew that there were going to be issues involved. So they contacted in the end of June an attorney in California that knew about legal rules regarding being involved in politics. So they knew that they were going to have to conform with some rules, and they knew back in June that they were going to have to conform with some rules. then according to the next one. The church's efforts in regard to Proposition 8 were almost entirely focused on encouraging members to donate their time and financial means to the committee. Included with the church efforts has been instruction from the church leaders to church members concerning the church doctrines relating to marriage. This is an important part for the when they're involved with something political and when they're talking to the Fair Political Practices Commission, because had they just been talking about something that was non-doctrinal, or had they been talking to people who were non-members, they would have had to report a lot more of the work that they had done. But since the church believes that a very large majority of its Proposition 8 expenditures and contributions are classified as member communications, they're not included with the category of reportable contributions. So that means that every time that they did something and it was focused on just going to the church members, they didn't have to tell the rest of the world what they were doing. That was an important part in getting volunteers trained, getting the information to volunteers to put out on their own websites and stuff like that. Proposition 8 related news releases and commentary were prepared by church employees, several of whose efforts during relating to property matters did not exceed 10% of their work time in any calendar month. So the church is very aware that if it had any employees working on Prop 8 related stuff, that they only could, that they had to keep their time each month under the 10% threshold. So as long as they had different employees working on it during the month and it was less than 10% of their time, they didn't have to report that contribution. It turns out that they were preparing the response and they found out that some of their employees actually exceeded 10% of their time during some months, and so they ended up having to report that percentage of the time. If you've got a big department of PR folks and, they work 40 hours a week and then they can spend, 10% of that time, each person can spend up to 10% of their time and have it be not reportable yet. So there's really kind of a lot of work that somebody could do behind the scenes and not rise to that necessity of being involved. And here it's that example, as close to the line as you possibly can. And oops, we went over a little bit. Finally, the church originated a single satellite broadcast. There was a question as to how many satellite broadcasts. There was only one broadcast that they did. And this is how they justified it, the fact that it was not something that the whole cost of the broadcast was not something they were required to do. It was aimed at California residents volunteering on behalf of the committee. California young single adults, California residents attending college in Utah, Idaho, and Hawaii. And the broadcast originated in Salt Lake City and primarily featured instruction and teaching from church leaders regarding church doctrine and traditional marriage. Now you can go look at the transcript of that and see how much is related to doctrine, how much is a pep rally to get you going out on the streets and tell you exactly how much time and money you're supposed to commit. That's their judgment. Although the public was not barred from the church facilities during the broadcast, and the broadcast was not encrypted, the public was not invited or expected to view the broadcast. Now, I don't know, from Salt Lake City, apparently they must not have invited people, but I know that in our state and in the state next door to us and a couple other states, people were invited. And they said, this broadcast is for all the Mormons and all the young adults, and if you have friends who are involved in Prop 8, bring them along. So, again, that kind of goes to the, if they're already involved in Prop 8, they're not members of the church, but they're members of the coalition. They could justify that that's a member communication, and therefore the costs of doing that broadcast are not reportable, and we don't have to tell anybody that we're involved in mobilizing volunteers because it's not reportable. So this secondary letter is, it says the church is taking its reporting responsibilities seriously, and it wants to keep cooperating with the FPC. And then they include some backup documentation of what they've been doing. And one of the things that they include is the church's non-monetary contributions, which a list of them, which consisted almost entirely of legal expenses, which was most of the legal expenses were actually in the middle of the year, just right around June and July. Traveled to California for meetings with church members and representatives of the Yes on 8 committee, the cost of producing videos and graphic elements related to Proposition 8, and reportable employee time spent preparing news releases and public commentaries, producing videos and widgets, and supervising volunteers making telephone calls to the California lawyers. So the church is involved in a lot of things. And at every press conference, they're saying the people who are involved are individual members. They're acting on their own. They're citizens of the United States, and they have every right to donate and to volunteer and to do what they want to. However, how many of those people would have been donating their time and money if they had not had the inspiration to do so from the church leaders? So it's a little duplicitous that the church would continue to insist, and as it has done in all those previous campaigns, that to say that, or we're not, to say on the one hand and to the public, we're not involved, and these are people who are doing their own thing, versus rather than we are involved in egging them on and getting them to do what they need to do. So in my opinion, it would show much more integrity, honesty, discipline, fairness, faithfulness in members and in the community, as well as respect for the political process and the constitutions of our country and our state, which allow freedom of speech, assembly, and worship for churches to cast off the fear of public opinion and speak up forcefully and purposefully in the public square for everyone to see and hear. One of the rules of good public relations is full and immediate disclosure, then fix the problem. In the internet age, it's not possible to keep member communications strictly among members, so why insist on those legal listed definitions when referring to training materials, talking points, satellite broadcasts, or even doctrinal proclamations? Opponents will always be upset about church involvement in political campaigns, especially when that involvement successfully musters volunteers and dollars. In a democracy that is free and robust, an opinion is no more disqualified for being religious than for being atheistic or psychoanalytic or Marxist or just plain dumb. I didn't say that, it was Richard John Newhouse. But on the other hand, the opposite is also true. An opinion is no better qualified just because it's religious than the non-religious opinion. So while some may cringe at the idea that churches speak out on political moral issues, I don't see a problem with adding yet another voice, sometimes even a more reasonable charitable voice, to the political discourse. I do, however, insist that the voice is honest and above board and out in the open and disclosing all the things that it's doing in order to make it fair and balanced, to use a term of art. Let's aim for more disclosure, open the knowledge that we have an interest in the law, and fully, promptly, completely tell the world about our involvement. The rest of the world is going to find out anyway. They might find out sooner rather than later, and they might as well get the truth straight from the horse's mouth rather than the conjecture from the jackass down the street.
The study was designed actually to look at immigration activism and human humanitarian activism for migrants in the Arizona desert, but because of the timeliness of Prop 102 and the timeliness of the study, and that's when I wrote a proposal in a different class and wanted to look at this, and so Craig Beierlein, the principal investigator of the study and my advisor, let me add some questions. And these were the questions that we asked. Have you heard of the proposition? Did your congregation do anything about the proposition? And what were up to three things your congregation did? And the strength of this data compared to other surveys, congregation surveys of this type, is the depth of the information that you got. So most surveys talk about if they did something and what site it was on, but that's it. And that's really, as you'll see in some of the graphics, the strength of this data is seen. There's a big difference, actually, in levels of commitment to the participation. Okay, so 98% of the 293 had heard of the proposition, which basically shows how common it was just in the cultural landscape and how salient of an issue it was for congregations. 48%, did your congregation do anything about the proposition? 48% did, which that was sort of surprisingly high because the other nationally representative studies, there's a few, but they hover around 40% of congregations are involved politically in any way, and this is just on one issue. And so I think that's a big part. A part of that is just the context. When you have these issues available for congregations to act on, they're more likely to get involved politically. So here's kind of this graphic. I'm going to just try to hold that, but. The colors are really important to see here, but basically, and it's kind of small, I guess. In the original design of the study, Mormons weren't even going to be included, and there were a couple of reasons for this. First, there's a question whether, sociologically speaking, Mormons should be classified with other Christians, and that is there's no stake here in the theological debate about Christianity, but under the kind of Rodney Stark, Janczyk's view, Mormonism is considered as a new world religious tradition which stands apart from traditional Christianity. Second, we suspected that there would be little or no variation across Mormon congregations, in which case, when you have no variation, using statistical analysis for causal inference becomes more difficult. Third, we suspected that the response rates with Mormons would be lower, bringing down the response rate for the entire sample, which it just makes it harder to hold up your sample as representative of the population of congregations you're trying to talk about. And so Craig, my advisor, didn't really want to do it, but because I was doing Prop 102 and really needed to the data, even if all those problems were true, which it turned out they kind of all are, I still wanted to be able to show that empirically. And so we sampled 50 congregations and only got 21, which the response rate for the rest of it was closer to 80%, and then the Mormon response rate was 42%. A lot of that just has to do with the lay leadership and difficulty of getting in touch, and the ease of getting in touch with someone who works at their church all day, every day, and can call any time in other congregations. So, yeah, like I was saying, as it turned out, all the reasons that we almost didn't collect the Mormon sample at all were sound for basically the same reason. Focusing on congregations as a unit of analysis, Mormons are very just fundamentally different from other Christian traditions. And it's been argued before that the single most important factor in understanding Mormonism in sociological perspective is the fact of the lay clergy. And I would add to that the related fact that Mormons serve for short periods of time in leadership positions, leaving less room for the kind of increased innovation that may occur over longer periods of time in a particular position. And these two factors result in an incredible amount of centralized bureaucratic control, which results in the little or no variation across congregational contexts. And this shouldn't be surprising. It's the explicit purpose of correlation to basically make the experience in every ward across the world similar. So basically, what this means is that my finding with respect to Mormons in the with congregations in the Mormon tradition is somewhat of a null finding. And I'll explain more what I mean about that in a minute. My paper was about actually all traditions, and I'm focusing on the Mormon case here. But let me just say a couple of things about some of the other traditions, just briefly interesting. So presented here are four categories of support/opposition across four religious traditions, okay, and then one other category. So if you can tell, I mean, it's hard to see here, but basically, I actually was able to distinguish four levels of opposition and four levels of support. So basically, kind of degrees of support or opposition to the proposition. And here, for simplicity's sake, I only have it two. So I have high and low opposition and high, and then no support is the gray, which you can't really tell, but it's more brown there. And then high and low levels of support. Okay, so, and the distinction I made between high and low levels of support came down to the extent of congregational resources expended on proposition activity. So for example, if within a particular congregation, they said that we preach on the importance of traditional families, okay, and that was all they said they did, that congregation would be categorized as a low-level supporter, because other than the opportunity cost of pulpit time, no congregational resource was spent. And that's actually, the majority of congregations outside of the Mormon tradition are low-level supporters, the majority of congregations who supported the amendment. So basically what that means is that congregations in other supporters of the proposition, anti-gay marriage congregations, in other traditions besides Mormonism, their stake in it was only to place themselves symbolically within a particular boundary, so they may preach on it, but they didn't actually expend organizational resources. So basically, they pretended to care because that was an important part of their constituency, and people self-selecting the congregations that they think will be aligned with their values, but they didn't actually do things that had causal efficacy in the outcome of the election. Outside of the Mormon tradition, like I said. It's here you can see for evangelicals, 4% of congregations were high levels of support, while 46% were low levels of support, and then the other 50% did nothing. And the Catholics are basically the same. The numbers, the evangelicals is the first on the left, the Catholics is right in the middle. And those numbers look slightly different, but statistically speaking, there's actually not enough. It's a fuzzy picture to make an inference from a sample to a population. So you can think of that as like, this is a snapshot of what's going on, but it's actually kind of out of focus because it's just a sample. And so with that out of focus, we actually see no difference. So Catholics and evangelicals were surprisingly basically participating at almost the exact same levels in terms of the percent that participated at high levels of support and percent that participated at low levels of support. But then interestingly, the causal combinations of factors that led to that support were different in each case, which I guess you would expect that. And then I guess the other interesting finding about the other traditions is in the mainline tradition, you see there the second from the left, and that high one that's gray actually, it looks more brown. 70% of mainline congregations did nothing about, so you might think that congregations in the mainline tradition are more sort of apathetic about getting involved politically. But they're the only tradition, so 20%, if that represents, I think, 26 congregations, 20% of the mainline congregations, so when they do get involved, they're highly activists. So that's the thing about these churches that are on the left side of the political spectrum, is that they're usually more apathetic, but those that are politically active are highly active, and their activity match that of the Mormon congregations in terms of the political resources and the things that they did. And those are usually, this is like United Church of Christ, PCUSA, United Methodist Church, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. These are kind of the mainline congregations, and they actually have designations in each of their denominations for if they're gay support, you know, kind of gay friendly. And so those were mostly those. So let's see. I'm skipping some stuff. So I just want to give one quick example of what I was doing in my analysis. And I need to do this, show you this example. For one thing, it's interesting in itself, but for another thing, it will help illustrate why I can't do something similar for the Mormon congregations in regards to a causal analysis of why did Mormon congregations participate. So basically, the results are kind of more technical than what I'm presenting here. For the sake of simplicity, this is the gist of the analysis for mainline congregations. Okay, so this is a set of causal factors. Any congregation that features this set of factors formally quality and congregational leadership, educated congregants, educated clergy, and that just means relatively educated relative to other congregations, and then orientation towards social justice as opposed to personal salvation. Any congregations in the data set that feature these characteristics, that's like a sufficient condition. This combination represents a sufficient condition to cause participation in opposition to Prop 102. And furthermore, approximately two-thirds of all congregations who oppose the proposition fit this description, which makes this combination highly empirically relevant set of causal factors. And that's the kind of analysis that I did on all the different traditions. And this is just one example. Going back to this slide, I could show you similar findings for all the traditions if we have time, but I want to spend the remainder. I'm going to spend the last 5 minutes here talking about the Mormon case. It's not possible to do that kind of analysis because there's no variation. So basically, it always just reduces to being Mormon. The cause of Mormon congregations doing it is being Mormon because they're all the same in terms of their general makeup, and they all have very similar. You can see here the Mormon one is the fourth one from the left, and 76% of congregations in the Mormon tradition participate at high levels of support, and then the other 23% participate at low levels of support. None claim to do nothing, and I actually suspect that those low levels of supporters underreported. If we would have asked more specific questions like, did you do this, did you do this, did you do this, we could have gotten more yeses that would have put them in the higher category. But then I got several caveats, and one person saying, I've been instructed to tell you that it's not our congregation that does these things, it's the individuals of the congregation that are organized to do it. And that was repeated over and over again, and finally someone told me that, you know, I'm kind of supposed to tell you that it's not at the congregational level. So what I said earlier is that this is kind of a null finding, meaning that there's not really a statistical explanation for what's going on with the Mormon congregations because of the uniformity and participation across the congregations in Mormonism. And in fact, in the paper that I wrote, the findings on Mormons is almost more of a footnote than anything else. But the problem with this, the reason why this is unsatisfying to me is that in my sample, okay, I have 293 congregations in my sample, 24 of the 293 mobilized at high levels of support for Prop 102. 16 of those 24, or two-thirds, were Mormon congregations, and that actually represents an unweighted statistic. So our sample, and to get, sorry, slightly boring technical, our sample was stratified by religious tradition, and because of the methodological limitations discussed earlier, we actually undersampled Mormon. So once we actually weight that, with that weighted number, it's probably closer to 80% of congregations who mobilize at high levels of mobilization were Mormon congregations. So it's such an important part of the story in terms of understanding the religious influence on Prop 102. So that's why it's kind of really unsatisfying to not be able to look at this statistically. At least our survey instrument wasn't. There's good reason to believe that congregations who participate at lower levels have very little causal efficacy. It's been shown that preaching on an issue, on a political issue, has little net effect on voting outcomes of congregants, and this is because congregants are self-selecting into congregations likely to preach on things they already agree with. And so the things that matter, the things that Mormons, they basically mobilize, donate money, make phone calls, things like that. Okay, so in other words, most congregations didn't really care that much, even though many of them pretended to. So why? The question still is why New Mormons care so much. And so I'll have a couple of conjecture. I don't have data on this. These are some of the reasons that people give, you know, as it's been discussed on blogs and things like that. Cultural investment in patriarchal power structures or belief in traditional families. This is basically kind of the documentary 8, the proposition, that kind of argument that it's about the unique theology. This is the most popular explanation. Well, I think this definitely plays a role. It doesn't explain the uniqueness of the Mormon case because other faith traditions have similar investment in patriarchal culture, especially Catholics and some evangelical congregations. So if we're looking at, you know, kind of comparative analysis, this investment in patriarchal power structures and patriarchal culture doesn't explain why the Mormons used it so heavily when those other traditions did. And, okay, so this is kind of an interesting one that I heard that I've heard a few times. If the government gets out of the business of marriage, the Mormon theology will require a return to the practice of polygamy, theoretically, which is the last thing that church leaders want to deal with. And so that's what's like secretly, subconsciously, this is what I've heard, subconsciously promoting them to act so strongly. I don't know if I buy that, but I think that what's interesting about this explanation is that it's kind of an acknowledgement that Mormonism is in such a unique position with respect to marriage law in the United States, and that this plays a crucial role. Mormonism's relation to marriage law in the United States historically plays a crucial role in the way the church responds to issues of marriage law. Okay, and then the last one is, it may be the case that individual Mormons don't care that much more than individual evangelicals or Catholics, but that the bureaucratic structure of the LDS Church is such that the slightest whims of those in power in the LDS Church are much more effectual than those in other traditions. And this kind of goes along with a lot of the culture wars type literature, which suggests that America isn't nearly as polarized as it might seem, but it's leaders and cultural elites that are more polarized. Again, if the leaders are at this polar end and they have so much bureaucratic and organizational control, it makes the power of the church that much more. So I think an adequate explanation of Mormon support of anti-gay marriage initiatives should take into account the validity of all these explanations while sufficiently explaining the uniqueness and historical contingency of the Mormon case. So in other words, I look for more of a historical qualitative answer to this question. And just this, the last slide, just kind of my conclusion, is to think about this in terms of co-production, okay? Co-production between the field of law and the field of religion, especially marriage law in the United States. So 19th century, this is just going to be this really brief, 19th century, you see the existence of Mormonism in the United States significantly shapes the development of U.S. marriage law, and Sarah Barringer Gordon's sort of classic book on that. That documents that process. And then in the 20th century, you see U.S. marriage law significantly shaping the development of Mormonism as it is practiced. So basically, Mormons, the fact that Mormons are there affects the way marriage law develops, and then that marriage law in turn has a feedback effect on the way Mormonism develops and is practiced, especially in the 20th century. And then now in the 20th century, Mormonism, specifically the LDS Church, challenges the further development of U.S. Marriage law. So what I'm suggesting is that from its inception, Mormonism was set on a course of path dependency and forever destined to be in tension with the family practices of the larger culture in which it is embedded. And people often remark sarcastically about a perceived reversal in the position of the church with respect to marriage law. First, Mormons wanted the government to stay out of the marriage business, and now they've done a complete 180, insisting that the government step in and restrict marriage rights. And I suggest that if we think in terms of this kind of idea of co-production and feedback effects, understanding U.S. marriage law as a product of the American practice of Mormonism and Mormonism as a product of U.S. marriage law, we can make strides in resolving this paradox while moving the congregation past the kind of blame and finger-pointing and moral indignation and towards greater enlightenment and knowledge as to why this is happening, why the church is doing this. And this is the kind of knowledge that I believe will empower us in shaping the future. And I kind of do think that it's, in a lot of cases, this is the sociology to me, it's not necessarily about individuals. It's about this organization that exists in this social context, and there are all these forces that are sometimes beyond the power of the individuals at the helm. And Mormonism's relationship with marriage law is just one of those, just forever destined to be a part of it in this culture, in this country. And that's what I got. Thank you.
We have about about 8 minutes or so, 7-8 minutes for questions or comments. And so this microphone really does not work well. So there's one right here on the stage, and I think that if you just come up and hold it, and that'll work a lot better. And speak into the mic so we can all hear you, and it'll get on tape and all of that. Thank you.
Boy, Laura, there's so much I want to cover. It's unimaginable.
Well, you're the first one, and then it's last behind me.
Well, there's a right way and a wrong way to do things. Maybe somebody from Idaho here can correct me, but my relatives in Idaho said the way the church conducted the campaign against pari-mutuel horse racing was wonderful. That there was outside interest, big Nevada casinos saying, come on, say you're a Mormon, run expensive ads. And they said, no, we're doing limited radio, and we're going to announce the Sunday before the election that the Mormons are against gambling. We think it's a bad idea. It'll affect the businesses there if more restaurants and everything are consigned to the pari-mutuel casino horse racing tracks. And the thing narrowly lost, and both sides said each side conducted themselves admirably. Contrast that with Prop 8, where I don't know where to begin.
Prop 8 stands out. It was all the others kind of a tidal wave compared to the lapping of the pond. And, you know, we can talk about this forever and ever, ever. I think that the church was probably surprised by the reaction. I'm sure that they knew that there was going to be some backlash. I don't think they had any clue that it was going to come as fast and as hard and remain as strong as it has been.
See, I'm surprised they were surprised by the backlash. Is that I listen to Catholic radio in Sacramento. I listen to a lot of talk radio. I'm on the internet all the time. I need to get a life, admittedly. But Catholic radio was upset, saying, look, we're glad the Mormons were with us on gay marriage. Where were they on Terry Schiavo a decade ago? Where were they on parental notification? Parents that the kids want to get abortions. That was on the ballot. The church did nothing to pass that. And some people think abortion is a lot bigger issue than this.
And the question of what the church deems moral and what the church says, you know, it wants to get involved in and what it doesn't want to get involved in is a big deal. I think we need to let some other people have some questions too. And
I hope you do talk about the way Prop 8 was conducted. If you can get into what general authorities financed, what the little girl had was despicable. That family, remember that, the Marin County, that they lied about why the little girl was...
Yeah, let's have a minute.
I guess that's one thing that I sort of felt like I was trying to answer that address that in at the end of my thing when I was saying that I think that there's the difference between these other issues is that Mormonism has a unique relationship with marriage law in the United States, and that explains the variation in their they don't participate in these other things as heavily because of that it's a historically contingent.
Well, we need to have that discussion why this is more important issue than drunk driving or abortion, which a lot of people
right.
Like.
Well, that's the discussion I'm having here. It's trying to say that that's why that's happening. So.
Hi, thank you, Laura. I always want to thank you whenever I see you for all your work. And I thought this, Joseph, was a really important study. I'm really glad to hear that you pushed for Mormons to be the Mormons in Arizona, not a statistically significant. It's crazy. So I'm really glad you're pushing for more scholarly work about more political involvement to be done. And I was interested in hearing you shift from the quantitative analysis at the end to the qualitative analysis and start talking about the role of narratives. And I love your kind of framing of different narratives for why the church was getting so involved in this. And I've heard, you know, I think a lot of us who were opposed to Prop 8 have been trying to generate our own sets of narratives about why this tidal wave response we've seen in Alaska, we've seen in Hawaii, we've seen it, and then bam. And so I'm just interested in hearing other people gossip about, like, on-the-ground narratives they've heard about why this tidal wave response or anything, Laura or Joseph, you've collected, because I like those narratives too.
I think that, it has to do with the fact that just from the beginnings, you know, marriage in Mormonism and Mormon culture and Mormon theology is such a crucial part of the story, and so we just take a big interest in why, in what's going on in the larger culture that's going to affect us. And
I think another thing to keep in mind is the political reality in California, that it is a state that often leads the country as goes California, so goes the rest of the country. The California elections are very easy to influence if you can get enough money, enough volunteers involved. It's very easy to get something on the ballot. It's very easy to get something through. And so that it becomes something that you can influence, whether you're inside the state, whether you're outside the state. We see this all the time in California. The ballot measures that we vote on over and over and over again is absolutely insane. And it's something something that needs to be fixed. But I think that we have the kind of a perfect storm of the church has a high interest in marriage and its ideas of marriage. It is able to provide the influence, and there's a significant amount of Mormons in California where they have the opportunity. And you bring that all together in a bellwether state, and you have to get involved if that's important to you.
Well, Laura just said half of what I... Is that on? Okay. Push it up. There we go.
All right. Laura just said half of what I was going to say. But the question of why the church is so involved or why the members are so involved, it's really two questions, I think. And the first question is why does the hierarchy care so much? And to really understand that, you've got to go back a long ways. You probably have to go back to the 19th century, but in my lifetime at least, you've got to go back to the ERA. And the whole idea the church's involvement in the ERA was this changing of roles for women that undercuts the patriarchal structure. And so the church got involved then because homophobia and sexism are the twin relics of patriarchy. And they go hand in hand, and you need to understand that if you're going to understand why the church cares so much. Last year I did a presentation at Sunstone about the ERA because it was like 25th anniversary, so I'm not sure why we did it exactly, okay, but in any case, I went back through all of my files, and one of the things I pulled out of the file was a paper done by Richard Wilkins, a law professor at BYU, who has been very active in this since ERA days, and what was striking to me about it was how much of his anti-ERA argument was related to the idea that if women had equal rights, then we would have gay marriage. And so what happened in the end was women didn't get equal rights, and we got gay marriage anyway. So the patriarchal roots of the church are behind all of this, and that's the one why. The other why is touched on in the Eighth Mormon Proposition, which is that Mormons invest tremendous confidence in their leaders and a tremendous sense of loyalty to the church and to its mandates and to their temple covenants. And so the reason the congregations are involved is because they've been told to be involved by their leaders. And that's really something that has to be understood in order to understand more Mormon involvement in these issues.
We'll have just one more question. I just want to make one comment right before that I think that in addition to Mormons having confidence in their leaders, I mean, the Mormon leaders are also asking people to do home teaching and get food storage and to do all kinds of things that they don't choose to do, right? And so obviously the request has to resonate with them. And so what is it that resonates with regular members? And I think and especially if you're going to contrast that with other Christian denominations, the biggest difference that I can just see is that marriage is part of your salvation in Mormonism. Whereas in other Christian religions, salvation is a separate thing from your marriage and family. And so I think that's kind of where it kind of just connects with Mormons when they get worried about marriage being under attack. And then when you say that gay marriage is attacking your marriage, then it kind of sets the defenses off. I mean, that's probably what was going on.
That is probably true, but probably within any congregation, fewer Mormons were involved in Prop 8 than failed to do their home teaching. So,
yeah.
Well, this is a crystal ball question. And if the Supreme Court does not, if they do overturn the current decision by the federal court circuit, and allows Prop 8 to stand as is, a lot of the these different propositions in all these states passed by pretty small fractions. Arizona, it was about 8%.
56-44.
Yeah. So in about a decade, do you perceive that the church will still be fighting when maybe society, the 30 and under, become the dominant force in the voting bloc? And will the church continue to put on that fight? Because, for example, in Argentina, it seems like they kind of knew they couldn't fight it. And they just did the statement in the church and then just accepted defeat. What are your feelings on the next 10 years when society as a whole changes their view? Will the church continue to accept the bad media and to put themselves out there?
Tell me who's going to be alive and leading the church in 10 years, and I can answer that question for you. I think that the church will continue to teach its doctrines, and we've seen it mellow some in things that that's just such a crystal ball thing to do, you know. Maybe not in 10 years, but maybe in 50 years, it will change. I think it's going to take the prophet asking the question. And if the prophet asks the question and gets an answer, everybody's going to accept the answer. But until the prophet asks the question, or until there's some unification in the quorum, there's not going to be a real definitive statement, I don't think, other than marriage is really, really important. But we do have to find a way to accept all of the members of the church, including the ones who are legally married gay people, if there are some that want to be in church.
I'll just leave you with a juicy prediction about Mormonism and marriage. And that, well, in regards to the question, I think that the church will be tapped out into behaving, and just because of the wave of sentiment that's going to change. But the juicy prediction is that I think that the family in American culture is changing radically, and that Mormonism offers a resource of tradition and a strong cultural resource for innovation. So basically the juicy prediction I want to offer to close is just that Mormonism, maybe not the LDS Church, but Mormonism culturally will play an important role in the future of marriage in this country, will continue to play an important role because of the cultural resources it provides to people trying to innovate and come up with unique situations, a history and tradition that some of these, you know, kind of modern polyamorous communities can't provide. And Mormonism has a tradition, a theology, and a whole cultural backdrop to provide for that. So I think it will continue to play an important role as marriage evolves in United States culture.
Thanks.